The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning and good new year to you all. This is our first oral argument in the new year, and we're delighted to welcome today Waupun High School students. Would they please stand? Welcome. You may be seated. The high school students are here with us with a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from around the state are invited to come to hear oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, they are sent briefs on the case they are to hear, and they may do whatever additional work they want on that case. And they meet with a justice of this court at noon. Now, for others in the audience, if you want further information about the case we're about to hear, there is a summary of that case available in the foyer, or if you raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary of the case. With those introductions made, I am going to now introduce the court to you all. Seated at my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and she is the justice with whom you will meet at noon. And this invitation to meet Justice Bradley at noon is not limited to the students. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to be there is welcome. They will discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case. Seated next to Justice Bradley is Justice David Prosser. And seated to the left of Justice Prosser is Justice Lewis Butler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is an empty chair, and ordinarily Justice Patience Robensack sits there, but she will not be participating in this first case. So we will now proceed to call the first case, 03-0002-CR, State versus, and how do you pronounce the defendant's name?
Moak.
State versus Richard Moak. First addressing the court is Assistant Attorney General Daniel J. O'Brien. Mr. O'Brien.
Good morning. May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien, representing the petitioner, State of Wisconsin, in this action. The issue before this court is whether the trial judge, La Crosse County Circuit Judge Montalban, erroneously exercised discretion in ordering a mistrial at the close of evidence of trial when it became apparent that the defense was not going to put on evidence to back up a significant portion of its opening statement to the jury. That was a summary, and a very detailed summary at that, of Mr. Moak's anticipated trial testimony. After lengthy discussion with both counsel and after exploring alternatives such as a curative instruction, Judge Montalban ultimately decided to order a mistrial. The answer to the question whether it was an erroneous exercise of discretion here and whether this court should give great deference to that erroneous exercise of discretion lies in one single case, the United States Supreme Court's decision in Arizona v. Washington. Arizona v. Washington, in both its facts and its discussion of the law, strongly corroborates what Judge Montalban chose to do in this case. The court in Arizona v. Washington held that a decision to grant a mistrial based on improper argument by defense counsel is entitled to the same degree of respect and deference as is a mistrial declared due to a hung jury. And in fact, one of the earlier trials in this case ended in a hung jury, and there was never any challenge to that exercise of discretion by Judge Montalban to declare a mistrial. And the state insists that this ruling, with respect to defense counsel, the defense counsel's opening argument is entitled to the same degree of respect.
Counsel, isn't the problem here, as I look at this case, is not just the discretion, but how the trial judge exercised the discretion. In other words, there's a very, if you can point to some place in the record as far as the exercise of discretion, but I think that the judge, if the facts are wrong, as I understood it, the judge was going to give an instructive, some type of instruction as to the failure of the defendant to testify, which, of course, if it was on the other side, it would obviously be a mistrial granted or a dismissal because the defendant does not have to testify. Here, the judge sort of abdicated or at least indicated to the prosecution, if you're not satisfied, I assume you want a mistrial. Is that, have I misstated the facts?
Yeah, and I don't think you're misstating the facts. I think you're making, I'm not assuming that's your position, but I'm assuming that you're making the same mistake that the Court of Appeals did. I don't think that anyone abdicated anything here. I think what we have here, and I think if you look at the colloquy between the judge and the attorneys, and it's in the appendix to our brief at pages 146 through 52, I believe. Actually, it goes back further. 142 through 52. This was an evolving situation. The prosecutor, the objection was raised during the instruction conference. They were in the midst of discussing what instructions to give on a number of points of law. And then the prosecutor said, Your Honor, and I think this is at 142 and 143, I want another instruction. And then the prosecutor talks about the problem presented by defense counsel's opening argument, which was unsubstantiated by his client's testimony. And then there was a lengthy discussion. Well, what type of instruction should we craft? And the judge made at one point made an attempt at a proposed instruction, and there was some discussion whether or not that was acceptable. And then there was a follow-up question by the prosecutor at some point, well, what can I say in closing argument? You know, assuming we go along with that instruction, and of course there's a general instruction that arguments of counsel aren't evidence, and then there was going to be, the judge talked about this more specific instruction that matters discussed in opening argument by defense counsel that were not substantiated by proof are not to be considered, or something along those lines. And then the prosecutor said, well, that's fine, but what can I argue in closing argument? And basically, that came down to a discussion of what you can't argue. You know, it was basically a discussion, well, if, as long as you don't say he didn't testify, you know, then you can make some reference to what was not produced at trial. And so in essence, there became this whole pirouette around the defendant's Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate or not to testify. And, you know, and as this discussion evolved at that point, at one point the prosecutor said, you know, I'm not sure we may want a mistrial. I want to go to talk to my supervisor, Scott Horn, District Attorney Horn. And the judge said, why don't you do that? Take this proposed instruction that I prepared to him and see what he thinks. And there was and then they came back. And the judge said, the prosecutor said, I think I'm going to request a mistrial, but again, revisited this question of, well, you know, just so I'm clear, what could I argue in closing argument? Because I think the prosecutor made the comment, I wouldn't be very kind to defense counsel in light of what was not produced at trial. And again, the judge was saying, well, don't don't say that he didn't testify because we'll be trying this all over again, I think was his phrase. And, you know, at that point, the prosecutor said, well, I want a mistrial. And the judge said, you know, this whole idea of abdication, the judge said, and I hope I have it right here, at some point the judge specifically said, I think the state would be entitled to one. And then, if they want one. I don't see that as abdication. What I see that as is a decision that there is sufficient necessity for a mistrial. And then asking the prosecutor, I can grant you one. There's enough here to grant one. Is that what you want, or do you strategically want to waive your right to a mistrial? And the prosecutor, in response, said, no. I think there's a sufficient problem of jury taint here that can't be eradicated. And the judge essentially agreed.
Well, Mr. O'Brien, why couldn't it be eradicated? You have a situation where on in the opening statement, the defense counsel says that here's what happened, right? And then describes that Rich is asleep, that Chris knocks on the door, etc. And does the defense counsel ever say that that's what Rich is going to testify to?
Yes.
In the opening statement?
Yes. I mean, he specifically refers, he says, and again, let's see if I can find it here. At the outset, okay, he refers to the victim, Chris. Chris has testified, as Ms. Matusek, the prosecutor, said, at previous hearings in this matter. Rich has done the same thing. So now we're referring to prior testimony. And the only person in this case that has been consistent with their story and with their testimony is Rich. And then he launches into a discussion of what his testimony will be. And it goes on at some length. And so I think, and then he concludes that summary by saying, and that story, ladies and gentlemen, is the only story that's been consistent throughout this case.
Right.
So the jury's waiting with bated breath to hear that story, and they never heard it.
They never heard it. And you have to say they're waiting in with bated breath to hear it from the defendant.
From the defendant.
That's your position.
That's correct.
Okay. Why couldn't they cure that with an instruction that says, and it's probably a standard instruction, that the opening statements are not evidence, that to the extent that they describe evidence that is ultimately not introduced, you're to ignore it. I mean, that seems to be
handling
it. We allow curative instructions all the time.
Right. And that is certainly an alternative. I'm not going to sit here and say that couldn't have been done here. But I hearken back to Arizona v. Washington, where the court specifically acknowledged in that case where there was an improper defense opening argument. The court specifically said that perhaps a curative instruction would have worked here too. But that doesn't mean it was unreasonable and an improper exercise of discretion to declare a mistrial.
Well, Mr. O'Brien, you're not arguing that the opening statement was improper, are you? You're arguing that there was no evidence to support the opening statement. In other words, if the evidence had come in, the opening statement would be just fine, correct?
Right. I believe that's correct. That if had the evidence come in, it would have been okay.
And isn't that the distinction between Arizona versus Washington in this case? In Arizona versus Washington, you had clearly improper arguments being made. In this case, you had what is an appropriate argument, but no evidence to support the argument. Is that correct?
Yes, but I don't know. I think that's a distinction without a difference. The ultimate result is that there was no evidence. There was no evidence admitted at trial to substantiate the argument in either case.
And I guess I'm raising the question because I do see a distinction here with a difference. Why then didn't the state argue in the trial court level, United States versus Robinson, where the United States Supreme Court, and you cite it in your brief, I believe on page 27, but where the U.S. Supreme Court says, but whereas in this case the prosecutor's reference to the defendant's opportunity to testify is a fair response to a claim made by the defendant or his counsel, we think there is no violation of the privilege. Isn't there another way to have handled this?
There is another way, but again, I go back to Arizona v. Washington. The fact that there is a possibly another way does not mean that it's the only way, and it does not mean that it's an erroneous exercise of discretion to choose a mistrial, and especially in this situation. You know, again, I refer back to the nature of this particular argument. It was a detailed summary of the defendant's exculpatory testimony, which at the same time painted the victim as a bald-faced liar. And it was not clear what the prosecutor could argue. You know, opposing counsel relies heavily on the State v. Johnson Court of Appeals decision, which is similar to Robinson and Frazier v. Cupp and some of these other cases. And those cases all realize that there's no clear line as to what is permissible and impermissible comment in response to this sort of an argument. And the prosecutor will be creating a great risk if Ms. Matusik referred at all in her closing argument to this lack of evidence. Now, it's very possible that had Mr. Moak been convicted, had an instruction given, had Ms. Matusik referred in closing argument to the fact that they didn't put on any proof to back up the summary of Mr. Moak's testimony, therefore you must disregard it. It's possible that that might be upheld on appeal because the defense in essence, waived any Fifth Amendment objection by proceeding this way. But that's a risk that I don't think a judge needs to take, and I don't think the prosecutor needs to take, especially when the whole premise of Arizona v. Washington is to protect the right of both parties to trial by an unbiased jury. And Arizona v. Washington specifically said that no party, the state or the defense, has the right to a trial by a biased jury. And the defense comments, the opening statement without evidence to back it up, ran a great risk of biasing the jury in favor of the defense. On the other hand, a comment by the prosecutor that the defendant, in essence saying that the defendant didn't testify to back up his counsel's opening statement, ran a great risk of biasing the jury in favor of the state.
The problem that I have with your argument, I think of Arizona versus Washington. Of course, there's a level of deference, and that case discusses the spectrum of the levels of deference to be accorded to a trial court's determination of mistrial, depending on the facts. But even after you determine, like the Court of Appeals here, acknowledge you have to look at the level of deference, I think they said here, but regardless of the level of deference, the state has the burden of showing a manifest necessity to support the trial court's exercise of discretion. And the analysis includes, when you analyze manifest necessity, whether or not there is another option. And the Court of Appeals concluded that the state failed to meet its burden of manifest necessity because, among other things, giving a cautionary instruction would have cured the problem. What's wrong with that analysis?
Well, I don't think it's clear that a cautionary instruction would have cured the problem. I mean, again, I don't think that necessarily unteats this jury. It might. But I think Judge Montalban could reasonably say, in light of the nature of this argument, in light of the fact that defense counsel vouched for the credibility of his own client, attacked through his client's anticipated testimony the credibility of the victim, and referred to the prior trials in opening argument, and argued that his client's testimony is the only testimony that has been consistent throughout, that this jury might still remain tainted despite a cautionary instruction. And if the prosecutor makes any reference in closing argument, there's a potential for reversal on appeal down the road, either under Fifth Amendment comment on defendant's silence or Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance of counsel.
But Mr. O'Brien,
what is your burden? But when you have the burden as the state of showing manifest necessity for a mistrial, what is that burden?
I believe
there's double jeopardy. So what's your burden?
I believe this court in Seafelt, and it correctly states the burden as reflected in Arizona v. Washington, which is a high degree of necessity. And it's not absolute necessity. It's not the only alternative. It is a high degree of necessity. And again, when one looks at what was said here and what was not produced here, and one considers the fact that this pink elephant is in the room to stay and the state didn't get to cross-examine this testimony, is it unreasonable? You know, in the words of Arizona v. Washington, you have to conclude that Judge Montalban acted irresponsibly, irrationally, and precipitately in declaring a mistrial here. And I just don't think that's reasonable.
But Mr. O'Brien, if I could, this isn't really an unusual situation, is it? I mean, an opening statement by design is to be given to tell the jury what one expects the evidence to show. The evidence doesn't always support the openings. Isn't that a correct statement?
That's correct. But I think this is unusual in a situation where you have with two unique factors here. This isn't just a summary of some witness's testimony. This is a detailed summary of the defendant's testimony, which counsel assured the jury they're going to hear, and it's in a one-on-one credibility contest in a case where the two prior trials focused on the one-on-one credibility contest, and then all of a sudden, at the close of evidence, the defense changes horses in midstream, changes their strategy 180 degrees, and says, no longer is this a one-on-one credibility contest. Now we're just going to argue that the state failed to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt based on the victim's testimony.
Doesn't the defense have a right to do that?
I don't think they do. Well, let's put it this way. If they're taking a risk in doing that, and they create a problem such as we have here, and especially when that, and I think that whole situation can be avoided by, especially in a case like this, where and it wasn't clear that he was going to testify when this argument was made. I think that's pretty apparent from the post-conviction testimony. The counsel didn't know whether he was going to testify. If that's the case, and you want to go to this length into your client's testimony, then it behooves you to wait until the start of the defense case to make that type of an argument. If you do not want to do that, then I would suggest that you make a more oblique reference to your client's testimony at the outset of the case, something to the effect of, I believe my client will testify, although he has a constitutional right not to, I believe he will testify and deny what happened here. But if you want to go into the detail that defense counsel did here, I would suggest that, as Judge Montalban reasonably concluded, just wait until the start of your case.
Mr. O'Brien, in considering a high degree of necessity or manifest necessity, should this court focus entirely on the individual case, or can we incorporate public policy?
Well, the only public policy, to answer your question, number one, it is a case-by-case analysis. I think that's clear from the U.S. Supreme Court cases. But the public policy that is incorporated into it is the right of both sides to have trial by a fair jury. And the public policy of a trial to end, a fair trial ending in a just judgment. And to that extent, that policy permeated, I think, Judge Montalban's decision here. He was concerned that this case would not end in a just judgment based on what happened here.
What I'm trying to get at is this. As I understand the facts, this was the third trial. The defendant testified at the first trial and the second trial. And then basically his entire defense was put in the opening statement in the third trial. It seems to me, at least something we ought to consider, that street-smart defendants will try to put in their whole case in the opening argument and then never be subjected to cross-examination.
Well, I think that's a legitimate concern, especially when, as we all know, it is the defendant's decision and not the attorney's decision whether or not to testify. And in this case, Attorney Gaskell testified at the post-conviction hearing that after Judge Montalban indicated that he might declare a mistrial, he actually did try to talk his client into testifying to avoid the mistrial. And his client said, oh no, things are going too good here. You know, counsel repeatedly refers to the fact that, the state wanted a mistrial because its case was going badly. You bet its case was going badly. I mean, sure, they had some significant credibility attacks on the victim, but they also put in the defendant's testimony without cross-examination. If that's allowed to stand, that puts the state in a real difficult position as far as reasonable doubt is concerned, even though the jury might be told, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. What he said in opening statement is not evidence, period. I just think that's, again, Arizona v. Washington doesn't say that manifest necessity means absolute necessity. It's a high degree of necessity. And I think Judge Montalban reasonably assess the situation here, as only a trial judge can. He sees the witnesses. He hears the attorneys. He sees the...
review of the record. There was not an opportunity for briefing, and the court's attention was not drawn to the oral decision of the trial.
Assuming they were summary decisions, they were the nevertheless decisions by the court, right?
Yes, they were. But the law of the case is not, it's not an inflexible, inexorable rule. And there are exceptions recognized to that rule by both this court and the United States Supreme Court, and those exceptions have to do, they center around whether the prior decisions were clearly erroneous or whether it would be a miscarriage of justice to allow those prior decisions to stand. And certainly in this case, where you have a mistrial decision predicated on a trial court's misunderstanding of the law, the trial judge believed that the argument was improper simply because the testimony wasn't produced. That's a misunderstanding of the law. That's an inaccurate definition of good faith. To predicate a mistrial on that and then to allow a court of appeals decision to stand based on the law of the case doctrine, that would work a tremendous miscarriage of justice for Mr. Moak, because there was no error in the case. There was no error at the third trial. Defense counsel's argument was entirely proper. It was made in good faith, and it was only the weakness of the state's case that resulted in his decision not to testify.
Isn't the opening statement of defense counsel equivalent to hearsay?
Well, it's not evidence, so in that sense it wouldn't be hearsay, but it's a summary of the lawyer's expectation of what evidence, admissible and relevant evidence, he will produce. And so in that sense, no, I wouldn't say it's hearsay. It's in the technical sense of that term. It's simply a remark of counsel. It's not evidence. I think hearsay, if it's admitted, would be evidence and could be considered by the jury. A statement of counsel, very clear, cannot be considered by the jury in reaching their decision. But if you want to use the non-technical sense of hearsay, you could probably say, well, that's true for defense and the state. This is what I expect the evidence will show.
And witnesses for both sides are often referred to in opening statements that might disappear during the course of the trial so that evidence never comes in.
Yes, I think that frequently happens. The witnesses, either maybe they don't show up, maybe they testify differently than what counsel's expectation is, differently than what the investigation would indicate they will testify. Maybe they change their testimony, and so the opening statement isn't borne out. Or maybe they claim a privilege, as happened in this case and in Frazier.
But on that Justice Butler's statement, the state could comment the fact that ordinary witness, not the defendant, didn't testify. Are you saying that the difference here is that it's the defendant, not just another witness? Am I making myself clear? In other words, this is the defendant who has a constitutional right. The prosecution could comment if you had three witnesses and they didn't show up and they were going to testify as to this or that. That would not be in question. The reason this is in question is because of the defendant. That's the main difference.
That's correct.
When we talk about witnesses, we're talking not a generic. We're talking basically about the defendant who has the constitutional right not to testify.
And yet,
that's a touchstone.
Yes, and in spite of that difference, counsel is not completely precluded from bringing to the jury's attention the fact that the evidence promised in the opening statement was not produced. And that's been clear by decisions in this court, as well as in the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court, that there is latitude given to the prosecution in closing argument when the defense promises testimony that only the defendant could give, and then the defendant doesn't testify.
I have not read Johnson and Edwardson for that premise. I just haven't read those cases yet. But with regard to the concern that the state is in some ways limited because it cannot comment on the defendant invoking the right not to testify. I mean, that's air. That's a big no-no in the courts, in our jurisprudence. Let me give you a hypothetical. Is the state precluded from this kind of response? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, during opening statement, defense counsel indicated what they expected the evidence would show. The court has instructed you that opening statements are not evidence. The court has instructed you that you have to base your determination solely on the evidence presented in this case. The court has further instructed you with regard to remarks of counsel that remarks of counsel are not evidence. That the remarks suggested certain facts and that evidence was not presented, that you are to disregard that suggestion. Is that kind of argument in any way improper?
No. No, that is a completely proper argument under Johnson, under Edwardson. That is simply emphasizing the law that the remarks of counsel are not evidence, informing the jury to focus on that question. It's not commenting on the defendant's silence. Now, the jury can draw their conclusions. They can make inferences from that. But there's no direct attack on the defendant's exercise of his Fifth Amendment rights here. And I think that's completely proper, and that could have been done in this case. And in fact, the court and the court suggested that in the oral decision. And so, you know, off the top of my head, I think as long as you don't get up there and say the defendant didn't testify, you're okay. And that's true. That is true. Off the top of his head, that was a very good summary of the law. It's there may not be a bright line. There's a bright line as to what you can't say, but as long as you stay away from that, you can tell the jury that the evidence wasn't produced here. I do want to address one point that the state made when they said that Mr. Moak refused to waive any objection to the state's making that kind of an argument. I don't think that's what happened at all if you look at this transcript, and you can't tell just by reading the transcript exactly what was going on in the party's minds. But the state, just prior to this, had told the judge that it wanted to get up and tell the jury that Attorney Gaskell had presented a fictional tale in his opening statement. And that, when you read this, that is what Mr. Moak is objecting to. He's thinking the state is saying, will you waive any objection to that? And he's saying, no, you can't get up there and say that I told a fictional tale. Because he's saying, I didn't tell a fictional tale. Just because I didn't testify in this trial, it's not a fictional tale what Mr. Gaskell summarized there. And that's what his objection, that's what he's responding to. The question of can he waive an objection shouldn't even arise, because under Johnson and Edwardson, there's no waiver issue at all. The latitude that a prosecutor is given is a latitude that the state has. And they can argue that whether there's an objection or not. There's no need for any waiver of Fifth Amendment rights here. I think the state's reading of that then is erroneous. In Arizona v. Washington, the court laid out this spectrum as to the review of a trial court's exercise of discretion. And the state has proceeded here as if this particular case falls down at one end of the spectrum, that addressed in Arizona v. Washington and Seafelt, where you have a hung jury or you have improper comments by defense counsel. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have the strictest scrutiny that should be applied to cases where the state is trying to take a tactical advantage of a situation. If there's reason to believe that the mistrial is being sought because the state is seeking a tactical advantage, then the reviewing court must give the strictest scrutiny to the trial court's decision. And in this case, there certainly is reason to believe that that's what's happening here. The state's case was a disaster. The state, if you read the cross-examination of Sater and of the officer, the state, it's certainly reasonable for someone to conclude that the state had failed to meet their burden. It's reasonable to understand why Mr. Moak felt he didn't have to testify here. The state didn't come into the jury instruction conference seeking a mistrial. They came in seeking a curative instruction. It was only after the court suggested the possibility of the mistrial that the state began to think, maybe I can get out of this bad situation that I'm in. Maybe I can have another kick at the cat here. And as the court continued to indicate to the state that if a mistrial was requested, it would be granted, the state finally said, I'll take it. But there's certainly reason to believe that this is what's happening here. The state realizes it's lost this trial. It needs another chance to try and convict Mr. Moak. And this is precisely the reason why we have the Double Jeopardy Clause, to prevent this kind of thing from happening.
Can a trial court declare a mistrial without a motion by either the state or the defense counsel?
Yes, I believe the cases support that.
You think this is such a case?
No, I don't think that's what happened here.
You think this is a case where the trial court relied on the state totally? Is that your picture of the case?
Well, I would say that the trial court gave the choice to the state, yes.
Right.
Basically delegated that choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. O'Brien?
Thank you. You know, I was looking at counsel's brief, and it's almost 11,000 pages long, and only once does it cite Arizona v. Washington, which, again, I insist is the controlling case here. Counsel focuses on Frazier v. Cupp. Frazier v. Cupp's a red herring. It's inapposite. It was decided 9 years before Arizona v. Washington. It is not a mistrial case. It involves the Confrontation Clause, and it is on appellate review of a defendant's conviction after a completed trial where the court is assessing a Confrontation Clause violation in the context of entire trial to see whether a curative instruction was sufficient to cure the improper comment. Moreover, the witness in that case, Mr. Rawls, was described as not a vitally important part of the prosecution's case by the court. The court went on to say, at least where the anticipated and unproduced evidence is not touted to the jury as a crucial part of the prosecution's case, it is hard for us to imagine that the minds of the jurors would be so influenced by such incidental statements during this long trial that they would not appraise the evidence objectively and dispassionately. On the other hand, we have Arizona v. Washington. This whole business of decided 9 years later, where we have an erroneous opening argument, and this whole business of good faith and bad faith, I suggest, is really irrelevant. The important point, as Arizona v. Washington points out, is the potential for a biased jury. And whether, I would suggest the defense attorney in Arizona v. Washington thought he was acting in good faith when he referred to the failure of the state to disclose exculpatory evidence at a prior trial, which ultimately was held by the trial judge to be improper because it was inadmissible evidence. But at the time, defense counsel reasonably believed that it was admissible, and therefore it was fair game and opening argument. So,
Mr. O'Brien, if the defendant had done the same thing in this case, I think Arizona versus Washington would apply. But there was no argument, or at least statement, an opening statement regarding inadmissible evidence. Isn't that correct?
In other words, it was a statement regarding evidence that was never admitted.
But that's a separate.
Well, the ultimate, it still taints the jury. Whether you're referring to inadmissible evidence or whether you're referring to evidence that you choose not to put in, and as a result, you taint the jury in your favor, you have a manifest necessity.
I guess the question that I have, and maybe this is the distinction you don't see that I see, it's one thing to argue to a jury something that is clearly inadmissible and shouldn't be before a jury. It's another thing in opening statement to present what you believe the evidence will show that is not inadmissible. And in this case, there appears to be a distinction between the two. I understand what you're saying.
We're all missing another crucial point here. The defendant has the right to appeal if he's unfairly convicted. If this jury is tainted by what happened here, and again, I would urge you to review those comments in defense counsel's opening statement to see whether a fair-minded juror might not be affected by them. The state has no remedy at all. And so if he wins an unjust acquittal, and again,
as Arizona v. Washington says, neither side has a right to a tainted jury. That includes the defendant. If he wins an unjust acquittal, the state has no remedy. Whereas, as in Frazier v. Cupp, if the state makes an improper reference to some witness's testimony, the defendant can appeal and say, hey, I get a new trial because that witness was never produced.
Mr. O'Brien, let me ask one other question, if I could. It goes to Justice Crook's questions earlier regarding the law of the case. I seem to recall that there may be some older decisions of this court that indicate that merely because a trial or because the court got it wrong is not a basis to overturn law of the case. Are you aware of any cases that stand for that proposition?
Off the top of my head, no. You may be correct. I just don't know. I don't think the Court of Appeals got it wrong. I think they were correct in the first two decisions, especially the second one on the Knight petition, where the court specifically said no amount of advocacy could convince us that the trial court erroneously exercised discretion. And at that point, they clearly had everything, even if they didn't the first time around, but I think they did at both cases. Moreover, one last point on the State v. Johnson case. I would invite you to read the case because I think it really helps the state here. Johnson points out, yes, you might be able to allow some comment on a defendant's Fifth Amendment exercise of right to silence if a right not to testify if he refers to an opening argument, refers to his own testimony, and then doesn't produce it. But it also clearly says it is impossible to draw a bright line as to what is permissible and impermissible response by the state. Then it goes on to cite Arizona v. Washington and quote from it for the proposition that both sides have the right to an untainted jury, which is really what we're talking about here, and that the defendant's Fifth Amendment right in that case against not to testify was outweighed by the valued public right of a trial to end in a just judgment. That is precisely what we're arguing in this case. That is what Judge Montalban concluded here. He did not act irrationally or precipitately, but properly exercise his discretion, which is entitled to great respect under Seifelt and Arizona v. Washington. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. That concludes our arguments on 030002 CR State versus Richard A. Moak. The court will take a few moments of recess while the students may leave, and we have a new group of students coming in. Thank you both for an excellent audience.